Coming up on Philosophy Talk...
What makes it true that it will be me who still exists, say, in some time in the future?
Derek Parfit and your future self.
Is your future self really you?
If I cut the connection between your left and right hemisphere, would there be two of you?
You're like two people, night guy, I gotta party, I gotta live. But what about morning guy? He's gotta get up. Screw him.
What's the difference between beaming up Captain Kirk and killing him and replacing him with a clone?
Is teleportation just murder masquerading as transit?
Basically, travel spreading a man's molecules all over the universe.
What's so wrong about valuing your own survival?
We're dying a little every day.
Our guest is David Edmonds, author of Parfit, A Philosopher and His Mission to Save Morality.
The Parfitian approach probably does weaken the commitments that we can make to our future selves.
Derek Parfit and your future self.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Twenty years from now, will you still be the same person you are today?
Will you still have the memories and personality that make you you?
And why do we think our future selves are so important?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about Derek Parfit and your future self.
Oh, Derek Parfit, he was such an interesting thinker. He had that really interesting thought experiment about the transporter.
Oh, yeah, I love that too. You're on your daily commute to Mars, you're about to get beamed up, but then something goes wrong. The transporter makes a copy of you on Mars like it's supposed to, but then it forgets to vaporize you back home. So now there are two of you.
Right, and if there are two of you, the question is, which one's the real you? The you on Earth or the you on Mars?
Well, that's obvious. It's the original. It's the you on Earth.
Obvious? That doesn't sound obvious to me.
Well, imagine if the transporter malfunctioned in a different way, and it didn't create a copy of you on Mars. You'd just be happily going about your business down here.
Okay, but look, when the transporter's functioning normally, you disappear down here, and you materialize on Mars. So clearly the Mars you is the real you.
Couldn't they both be the real you?
Well, not according to Parfit. Let's say your Mars self sets up, like, I don't know, an oxygen factory and marries the boss of the Thunderdome. And meanwhile, your Earth self is hanging out at a surf shop on Bondi Beach. These two people are living completely different lives. How can they possibly be the same person?
Okay, fine. One of them is you and one of them isn't. But why does it matter?
Well, maybe you wouldn't care that much in that scenario. But imagine this scenario. The Earth version of you only has one day to live, while the Mars version of you is going to live long and prosper. I mean, in that case, you better hope that the Mars version's the real you.
Yeah, okay, I definitely want to know whether I'm in for a long, happy life or certain death. But it seems like there's just no way of knowing. I mean, it's not like you can just ask them. Both of them would claim to be the real Ray Briggs. Both of them would look like me and remember my childhood.
Right, and it would probably be pretty confusing for your family and friends, too. Like, which Ray am I going to do this radio show with?
Yeah, those are all cool questions, but Parfit ends up saying something even more interesting. He thinks it doesn't even matter who the real you is. His slogan was, "Identity is not what matters."
I don't get it, Ray. Why shouldn't identity matter? Like, okay, I was very different at age 20, but I still feel responsible for the dumb stuff I did then because I'm still the same person. And I really care about what's going to happen to me in old age because that's going to be me too.
Parfit thinks you're right to care about your past and your future, but not because you're literally the same person.
But aren't I literally the same person? I've got the same name. I've been dragging this body around the whole time. I've always hated cilantro.
Fine, but that's not the thing that matters. What matters is that you can remember the stuff that your 20-year-old self did, and you can count on your 60-year-old self to carry out some of your plans. Plus, you have a lot in common with those guys. You like a lot of the same music. You have similar personalities. Heck, you even look related.
Yeah, but I have some of those things in common with people who aren't me.
Yeah, and Parfit says you should care about them too. That's exactly what's so powerful about this way of thinking. Suddenly you stop being so self-centered and start seeing yourself as just another thread in the tapestry of human life.
I do love that, Ray, and I love the idea that it also makes us less afraid of death. I'm just not quite sure I can believe it.
Well, I bet our guest can convince you. It's David Edmonds, author of a new philosophical biography of Derek Parfit. He also studied with Parfit back in the day.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear what Dave thinks about all this identity stuff, assuming that is, it is the real Dave and not his replica from Mars.
We didn't have the budget to send our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, all the way to Mars. So we sent her to speak with some writers and readers contemplating future selves. She files this report.
In the novel, How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe by Charles Yu, the narrator says, "Today is the beginning of the end, or the end of the beginning. He has killed his future self and is going back to his past to do it all over again." This all sounds very trippy, but it's also par for the course in science fiction. That's why I decided to ask science fiction writers what the future self means to them, starting with author Charlie Jane Anders.
I think that the future self is sort of a mythological figure that we conjure in order to motivate ourselves in the present, in order to justify ourselves or make sense of our lives. And oftentimes, if you're thinking too much about your future self, it means that either you're facing a huge choice or a huge challenge in the present, or your present really sucks. And like, it's actually an indicator that present you is getting shortchanged in the name of some future version of you that's actually a mirage. One of my first short stories that I wrote, which nobody's ever read really, was about someone having lunch with their future self, and their future self has become a supervillain. And because their future self is a supervillain, they're eating all the most cruel foods. They're eating veal, and they're like, that's how you know your future self has become a supervillain, because they're eating really whatever the opposite of cruelty-free foods are, they're eating those. And so, you know, it's just, why did I become a supervillain in the future?
The future self reminds science fiction author Tobias Bekel of a thought experiment, the ship of Theseus.
You know, we think of ourselves as like a coherent being that travels from one point to another. But the truth is, I often think about the fact that we're constantly shedding, you know, our cells and our being. And the idea of Theseus' ship is that, you know, if you replace all the planks in a ship, is it still the original ship or is it not?
Science fiction gives us a chance to imagine all kinds of futures, some of which may not be so far off from what actually happens.
It's not like we can predict them as science fiction writers, right? But just getting like, you know, a group of 10 to 15 science fiction writers gets you like that shotgun blast where between 15 of us, like, we're going to give you a wide range of scenarios. Probably one of those might end up being, you know, close to what happens. It's, you know, kind of like maybe you should have a team of people that sits there and thinks, how horribly can this go wrong?
And maybe scientists should be asking the same question science fiction writers love to ponder: how terribly wrong things can go. Take it from Daniel H. Wilson, a writer and robotics engineer.
I started out as a scientist, and I was extremely optimistic about all of this stuff. And I mean, a lot of times as a scientist, you're just making it possible, right? You're not really thinking about exactly how it's going to be applied. I mean, the purpose of the imagination is to think of a different version of yourself without having to become that version. You know, you think about, what would it be like if I tried to jump over, you know, that gap? Would I make it? Would I not? So I think that having all of this technology that can simulate humanity and that can really act like us and come to the human party with us, I think it gives us this opportunity to imagine a better version of ourselves in the future.
A better version of ourselves. At the end of Charles Yu's How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe, it turns out the narrator is okay, or at least it seems that way. The last page in the novel is left, quote, intentionally blank. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that transporting report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about Derek Parfit and your future self.
We're joined now by David Edmonds. He's a senior research associate at the Uhuru Center for Practical Ethics at the University of Oxford. He's also co-producer of the Philosophy Bites podcast and the author of Parfit, A Philosopher and His Mission to Save Morality. Dave, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
It's very good to be here. I'm the same person I was when I was last here.
That's what you say. So, Dave, you have this really great new book about Parfit, but this isn't the first time you've written about Parfit. How did it go when you wrote an article about him?
Well, it was a strange experience. I wrote about his marriage to Janet Radcliffe Richards, who's another philosopher. And it was a very long article. I was very proud of it. And I sent it to Derek because I wanted to fact check it. And I'd been at his house with Janet, and I'd been making lots of notes on my laptop. And I got this email back from Derek saying, Dave, thanks very much, but you're not going to like this, but I'm afraid you can't publish that article. And there was an attachment with it. And I was away. I rushed home. I opened the attachment. And there was a long list of mistakes that I'd made. And I went through it, and you know, I was very sort of anxious and nervous about this. And then it turned to puzzlement, because it turned out the first mistake wasn't in my article, nor the second mistake, nor the third mistake. And it finally dawned on me what had happened. I'd sent him the wrong file. I'd sent him my notes that I'd been making in his house, and not the article. And what was so weird about it was that nobody but Derek could possibly have thought that that was the article. It was full of these half-written sentences. It didn't have a beginning, it didn't have a middle, it didn't have an end. But I told him it was the article, so he was very literal-minded. He believed it was the article. It had a happy ending. I realised what the mistake was. I sent him the article, and he was very happy.
Wow, he sounds like quite an original. So I want to ask about another original contribution of his, which is his slogan, Identity is not what matters. Can you explain that slogan to us?
Yeah, so there's a puzzle in philosophy which goes back really 2,500 years, which is, what is identity? And Heraclitus says we can never walk into the same river twice. And people wonder, you know, what it is that makes the same chair over time. And within that big subject of identity, there's a kind of subcategory, which is personal identity. What it is that makes me the same person I was, if it was me, kind of 30 years ago, and which makes me the same person that I will be in 30 years' time. And whatever the answer to that question, Parfit thought it wasn't the central question. The central question was, what should I care about in terms of survival? And what I should care about is not identity, it's something else.
But wait, if I want to survive, don't I just want the same person, me, to keep living into the future?
Well, that's one way of surviving, but it's not the only way. So you were talking about the thought experiment where he imagines going to planet Mars, and he has a transporter, a bit like in Star Trek, although it turns out he'd never seen Star Trek. And it also turns out that in Star Trek, it's not clear quite what happens. So some Trekkies think that what happens is that you're physically kind of decomposed and you're reconstituted on planet Mars. And others believe that, no, what happens is a copy is made of you. Now, as far as Parfit is concerned, that doesn't really matter whether you're cut up into a zillion different pieces and transported, or whether a copy is made of you. What really matters is that that person on planet Mars is psychologically continuous with you. That's the key question, whether there's a connectedness with the person that was on planet Earth.
Okay, so let's get into that, because I can understand the idea. Look, if you get transported, what you care about is that you sort of whatever lands on the other side is the same person. Or if you fell asleep and you woke up in an identical body, not your body, but a replica, that would be okay, right? You wouldn't barely notice the difference. But what exactly do we mean by being the same? What do we mean by psychological continuity? What is it? So it's not my body that matters. It's not this sort of numerical identity. I'm exactly that person. But what do I need? Do I need my memories? Do I need my loves and likes and dislikes? Do I need my ambitions? What do I need in there?
Yeah, so John Locke, and Parfit is in a kind of Lockean tradition. John Locke emphasizes memory, that really what matters is memory. Derek's got a much more expansive view of what matters. So it's not just memory, it's inclinations, it's personality, it's dispositions, it's hobbies, it's passions, it's all those things that make you who you are, make you interesting. It's not your body. Your body is a sort of part of you, but scientists tell us that all the cells in our body change every 7 years. You know, if a weird sort of axe murderer comes in and chops off your little finger, you're still the same person. Your body is constantly evolving and changing. What matters to Parfit is that we have this strong psychological connectedness. If we have that, we can say that we're the same person. And if we don't have that, then the personal identity is somehow lost. And the crucial thing is that there are those connections in not just memory, but in all those other aspects of personality.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the life and thoughts of Derek Parfit with one of his former students, David Edmonds from Oxford University.
How concerned should you be about your future? Is it wrong to be afraid of dying? Should you really care more about yourself than about other people?
Selfishness, survival, and ceasing to be, along with your comments and questions when Philosophy Talk continues. If you live on in the people who know you, is the end really the end of you? I'm Josh Landy. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is David Edmonds, and we're thinking about the philosophy of his former teacher, Derek Parfit.
Got thoughts about your future self? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also subscribe to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Dave, you've been telling us that what matters to survival is that I keep a lot of, like, psychological stuff from my earlier self. So it matters that I have the same memories as the person who preceded me, but also sort of the same projects and the same personality traits. But it seems like I've got a little puzzle about that. So, you know, me 20 years ago had a lot of the same personality traits that I have now, and I remember me 20 years ago, but I've been changing the whole time. And I imagine that me in another 20 years will share a lot with me now, but not so much with me 20 years ago. So if I consider my 20 years ago self, like, in 40 years, will I really be able to say that I've survived if I've gradually changed over time?
Well, some bits of you would have survived, and some bits will be lost. I mean, your question is very relevant for all sorts of matters like responsibility and whether we're just as responsible for things that happened when we were kids as to things that happened a few days ago. And I think most of us believe that actually responsibility is slightly attenuated in the way that those connections are also attenuated, those psychological connections, so that, you know, if we were found guilty of shoplifting 40 years ago, well, that's enough of an insignificant crime for us maybe to dismiss it as of anything important, and certainly wouldn't justify punishment. Whereas if it happened yesterday, if we were caught shoplifting yesterday, well, we're sufficiently close to that person yesterday to think, well, I should be held responsible for it. So I think there is, over time, a weakening of our connectedness, and that is relevant for things like responsibility. It's also relevant for things like whether we should plan for the future, whether that person in 40 years' time is as close to me as that person tomorrow. So I think on Parfit's view, there is a weakening. You shouldn't think that that person 30 years ago is as close to you as that person yesterday.
And that's a really interesting aspect of Parfit's philosophy, this idea that it's sort of a matter of degree, right? It's not just I am the same person as that person, that Josh Landy 20 years ago. I'm a different person from Ray Briggs. It's, well, I'm more like that old Josh Landy than I'm like Ray Briggs. And then all these consequences follow. Like you say, there's an attenuation of responsibility for the past. There's a different relationship to the future. There's a different relationship to death. I mean, that's a really important consequence that Parfit wants to draw of it. He says, you know, my death seems to me less bad. Why? How does he get there? How does he get to less of a fear of death from his different picture of personal identity?
So a crucial thing about Parfit's concept of personal identity is that he's what's called a reductionist, which means he thinks we're nothing more than our minds and our bodies. So one way to illustrate that is to think of something like a chess club. And you imagine that there's a chess club, it's got a set of rules, it meets on a Friday night, there's tea and coffee served at 8 o'clock, people play chess within the rules of the game. Then if somebody says, well, what is the essence of the chess club? The answer, Parfit's answer, is there's nothing over and above the rules of how the chess club meets, what time it meets, what day it meets. There's no essence of the chess club. And that's the same with us. There's no essence of us. We're just these minds and these bodies constantly changing, sometimes in small ways, sometimes in very dramatic ways. Now, if there's no essence of us, if there's no, you know, like he doesn't believe in a soul, if there's no unchanging essence of us, in a way, one way to look at it is with I mean, this is a little depressing way of looking at it, but we're dying a little every day. You know, we're moving towards the end, we're dying a little bit every day. But the end point, when we're sort of biologically dead, is not such a dramatic end point anymore, because we're constantly changing. We're constantly moving towards that end. And so we're not, as it were, falling off a cliff. And one of the things you mention is that because the future me is no longer exactly like me, because we're constantly changing, our relationship to our future and our past also becomes weaker. We feel a slightly weaker attachment to our future selves and our past selves. And in the same way, we feel a stronger relationship to other people, because the difference between us and other people now also seems weaker. Under the old model, we had this essence. Ray has an essence. Josh has an essence. We're these very different creatures. In the Parfittian model, we're all constantly changing. There's no essence of us. My future me is different from my current me. And you cease to be so radically different to me as it earlier seemed.
So that's really important, because that gets us some of the diminishing of fear of death, because presumably, you know, it's a matter of degree. Some people in the world who aren't me have some degree of connection to me. I think Parfit talked about the people that we are in contact with, and maybe the people who remember us, and maybe the people who were, in Parfit's case, were inspired by his work. And in addition to giving us that kind of, well, okay, you know, something of me will survive after I'm gone, there's also the moral aspect, right? I should be better towards other people. I should not be so self-centered. I should understand myself as sort of, you know, just part of a web of connectedness in the world. Do you think that's a sort of good argument for being good, and in particular for getting us to the utilitarian position that Parfit seems to have embraced?
I find it a very compelling argument. It has a few paradoxes, which he doesn't draw out extremely well, but one of them is this. We tend to think that it's wrong to harm other people, but it's fine to harm ourselves if that's what we want to do. So, for example, I'm allowed to go mountaineering. It's a very risky hobby, but I'm permitted to harm myself because I'm sovereign over my life. And unless there's a good reason, you can't stop me doing what I want to do. Now, the paradox is that if my future self is not identical to my current self, if we're constantly changing in the way we've been discussing, then it's not clear that I have the right to harm my future self, because my future self suddenly feels a bit different from my current self. It feels a bit more like somebody else. So the question is, well, if that future self is not exactly like me, since I'm not allowed to harm you, how is it that I should be allowed to harm my future self? And if I'm not allowed to harm my future self, what are the implications for that in how I behave today?
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the philosopher Derek Parfit with one of his former students, David Edmonds, author of a new biography of Parfit. Dave, we've got an email from Tim in Portland. Tim writes, Parfit believed that morality was threatened by skepticism and moral nihilism and a need of saving. He sees morality as at least in part irreducible, and moral language as a hook to hang a foundation for objective moral truth and rational ethics, to put down the skeptics and nihilism. Do you think that that's an accurate summation of Parfit's project?
Yes, I'm amazed you've got some listeners who've read 3 volumes of On What Matters, which are 1,900 pages altogether. So I'm extremely impressed by the quality of your listeners. Indeed, that is the case. He spent the last 25 years of his life obsessed, really, with a single question, which is morality objective? And partly what he means by that is, are there moral facts? So when I say it's wrong to kill innocent children, is that a fact? And if you insist that you want to kill innocent children and you think it's fine to kill innocent children, are you making a mistake? Well, Parfit wanted to believe that you were making a mistake, that it was wrong to kill innocent children. And he thought that if that was not the case, then indeed morality was relative, life was meaningless, and our lives collapsed into a kind of nihilism. And he spent the last, as I say, quarter of a century trying to demonstrate that morality was objective and trying to convince all the other important philosophers in the world that this was the case. He got extremely upset, in particular with English philosopher called Bernard Williams, who wasn't convinced by Parfit's arguments. And it would bring Parfit to tears that he couldn't convince people of the calibre of Bernard Williams that morality was not objective.
So I'm a little bit more on Bernard Williams' side, I think. And I guess my question is, what if morality isn't objective? Like, why does it have to be objective? So it seems like if morality is objective, but there are plenty of people who just don't care about what's doing what's objectively morally right, convincing them that morality is objective won't help, and convincing yourself won't help. And if morality isn't objective, like, couldn't you still care about doing what was morally right?
I think Parfit is extrapolating from himself. So I think you're right. Most people don't think about this question. Most of us just live our lives. We actually probably do assume that morality is objective. We are instinctive objectivists. We think that there is a right and wrong. And if a philosopher comes along and says, I'm afraid you've made an error, morality is relative, it probably wouldn't make a difference to most of our lives. We'd carry on living our lives in exactly the same way. In the same way that if a philosopher came along and said, there's no such thing as free will, there's this thing called determinism, we're all part of a causal chain, you're not deeply morally responsible for your actions, well, we'd carry on living our lives, we'd carry on holding other people responsible, morally responsible for their actions. I think you're right. In the vast majority of cases, it wouldn't make any difference. I think Parfit, who had such a kind of cerebral relationship to philosophy in the sense that he lived his philosophy, I think he felt that if he believed that morality wasn't objective, he would feel completely at liberty to behave in any way he wanted. I don't think most people are like that, but Parfit genuinely believed that, A, he was like that, and he thought other people were like that too.
I want to get back to the question of, you know, whether the best way to get there is through what we started with, which is this new picture of personal identity, or whatever, personal connectedness, we should say, right? I'm not literally the same person as I was 20 years ago, but I'm more psychologically connected to that person than I am to some other people, and that's what matters. One of the things that perplexes me is why Parfit really thinks we would get both an increased sense of goodness, or an increased goodness out of it, and also an increased degree of calm out of it, you know, the sort of resignation to our mortality. I mean, you know, I think of that old line, I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality through not dying. And I wonder whether the idea of sort of my spirit somehow living on in, you know, my descendants or students or something like that is really, really, you know, palliates the fear of death. And the other thing on morality as opposed to mortality, well, maybe it's going to make me care about people who are connected to me. Right. So I care about them because they're not that different from me. But, well, doesn't that mean I'm going to care less about somebody I've never met, someone who, you know, lives far away and so on? Why would that be the best way of getting us to a more moral way of being?
Well, on your latter point, I think it gets us half the way there, doesn't it? I mean, most people's objections to consequentialism is precisely because it's too impartial. You know, the consequentialist will say the fact that so-and-so is my neighbour makes no difference morally to whether or not I should help them compared to somebody on the other side of the world. I mean, it might be practically more easy to help a neighbour than to help somebody on the other side of the world, but my neighbour is not morally more significant than the person on the other side of the world. And most people say that's ridiculous. You should care a lot more about your friends and family than you care about strangers. Well, Parfit's got a kind of, in a way, it's a halfway house, the way you express it, because obviously we should care about our friends and family more because they're more psychologically connected to us. They carry our memories and so on. So that's a Parfit has a reason why we should care about our friends and family and those who knew us, perhaps more than we care about other people, precisely because of this psychological connectedness. So it's sort of halfway between a strict consequentialist approach and a strict Kantianist approach. It says that we should care a bit less about ourselves, a bit more about other people, but it's understandable, because of this psychological connectedness, that we would care about our children more than we care about ourselves, because they're more psychologically connected to us.
I also want to know about this supposed lack of difference between me and other people. So you said earlier, if Parfit is right, maybe it's just as wrong for me to take myself mountaineering as it would be to, like, force some other random person into mountaineering and risking their life. But I don't know if this just affects my relationship with myself, because it seems like here's another thing that's okay for me to do. To ask my friend, who is an adult and capable of consenting, if they would like to come mountaineering with me, and to listen to their answer. Can I capture that anymore in a Parfitian framework, that their choices about their own life should matter morally to me in a way that just, like, trying to patronizingly benefit or avoid harm to them can't capture?
That's a very interesting question. It raises all sorts of puzzles about to what extent we can commit our future selves. So many of us write wills. We grant our husbands and our wives the ability to make decisions over our lives. We grant them power of attorney if we fall ill and so on. The puzzle that the Parfitian picture raises is to what extent our current self is able to bind our future selves. And you talk about whether somebody else's promise can be binding. I think that is a genuine puzzle. And I think it looks like, according to the Parfitian approach to personal identity, that there would be a reason to override that commitment in the future. That it might be reasonable in some cases to say, that person who asked us to act in a certain way asked us to do that 30 years ago, and now it's a different kind of person, and we shouldn't feel bound by that. I think the Parfitian approach probably does weaken the commitments that we can make to our future selves, precisely because we're changing over time.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about Derek Parfit and your future self with David Edmonds, author of Parfit, A Philosopher and His Mission to Save Morality.
How much should we care about people who haven't even been born yet? What about people who won't exist for thousands of years? Do merely possible people matter more than the here and now?
Back to the future. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues.
The robo boogie.
Oh yes, two kinds of dances.
Finally, robotic beings rule the world. The humans are dead. The humans are dead.
Does the distant future even matter if the humans are dead? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about Derek Parfit and your future self, with David Edmonds, the author of Parfit, A Philosopher and His Mission to Save Morality.
So Dave, you claim in your book that Parfit's the originator of long-termism, which is an idea that's been in the news a lot lately. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The basic idea is that future people matter as much as current people. So the fact that these people are not yet born yet doesn't make them any less morally significant than people who are currently alive. And the very simple thought experiment is to imagine that you drop a piece of glass in a wood, and the next day a young child steps on it and cuts themselves and bleeds. That's a bad thing, right? Now imagine that the piece of glass lies under some branches and leaves and stays there for 100 years. And in 100 years' time, another kid comes along and steps on the piece of glass. That's just as bad. The fact that that kid who steps on the glass in 100 years' time is not alive yet makes no moral difference. It's as bad that that kid steps on the glass as that that kid tomorrow steps on the glass. That's the basic thought.
Okay, so in that example, whether the kid is walking through the woods and whether the kid exists to walk through the woods doesn't depend at all on whether I dropped the piece of glass. But it seems more complicated in cases where my decisions affect, say, how many people are born or which people are born. How do I decide on the behalf of future people if I don't even know who they are and my decision might affect who they are?
Well, the fact that you don't know their identity is not per se relevant, just as the fact that if there's an earthquake on the other side of the world, you don't know the identity of the victims, that doesn't give you a reason not to help them. Parfit discovers a puzzle in the issues surrounding future people, and it's what is called the non-identity problem. So normally, when we think about morality, we think that if I've done something wrong, I've done something wrong to a particular person. So, you know, we're not in the same room, but Ray or Josh, if you were with me and I punch you on the nose, that's a bad thing to do because you would get hurt. Okay, Parfit spots something, which is that sometimes you can do a bad thing even though it's bad for nobody. And shall I just explain how that works?
Yeah, how can there be a victimless crime like that?
So he starts off by talking about a 14-year-old girl who is thinking of having a child. And obviously that would be bad for the 14-year-old girl, but we normally think, well, that's bad for the child. The child will get a bad start in life. It would be better if the 14-year-old girl postponed that decision for another 10 years or whatever. But then Parfit points out, well, if the girl does that, the child that will then be born 10 years later will be a different human being. Obviously, we're all a unique combination of a particular sperm and a particular egg. And if the 14-year-old girl goes ahead and has a child, so long as that child's life is better than nothing, we can assume it would be, that child hasn't been harmed by that girl's decision, because in the alternative world in which she postponed her decision, that child would not exist. And what Parfit points out is that many of our moral dilemmas have this kind of structure. And many of the policies that we think about to do with climate change and so on have this kind of structure because we can change the identity of the people who are born.
So that's a really interesting puzzle. There's another interesting puzzle around future generations that Parfit brings up, which has to do with how many future people there are going to be. So if you think every life has to count equally as a good utilitarian, and so we shouldn't privilege me over somebody else, and we shouldn't privilege this country over another country, well, we also shouldn't privilege now over the future. But there's going to be trillions of future people. And Parfit ends up landing in what he calls the repugnant conclusion, right? Which is that, you know, if we really took the consequences seriously of this way of thinking, we could imagine ourselves wanting a world packed to the gills with human beings, but who could barely move because there was no space and were barely subsisting. Because if you sort of multiply up, you know, all of the hedons, all of the moments of satisfaction that these barely subsisting human beings have, that sum is greater than the sum of hedons of smaller number of people living in the world. So how does Parfit get himself out of this particular problem?
Well, he doesn't. But let me separate two issues. One issue is you called it long-termism. In the future, there's going to be trillions of lives on planet Earth, providing we don't blow ourselves up. And maybe in the future when we colonize planets, there'll be trillions of lives on planet Mars and other planets in other galaxies. If that's the case, it may be the case that the future is more important than the present. So that if there's a conflict between the present and the future, we should care more about the future than the present, because there are many more people in the future than the present. That's one issue. The second issue is what you call the repugnant conclusion, which is a different issue altogether. So Parfit says, imagine a world in which there's 8 billion high quality lives. So in our current world, there are about 8 billion lives, but they're not all high quality. Imagine our world was better than it currently is. There's 8 billion very good lives. Parfit has a whole bunch of arguments which point in a single direction, which is the claim that compared to that world, there must be a world which has trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of lives in it, lives that are barely worth living, but lives which are worth living, but only just worth living, and that that world is better than the world in which there are 8 billion high-quality lives. And he calls that the repugnant conclusion. And he spends years and years trying to show how the repugnant conclusion doesn't follow from his arguments, and he can't. He ends up believing that the logic of the arguments prove that that world in which there are trillions of lives barely worth living is better than the world in which there are 8 billion very high quality lives.
So I have a question about lives worth living and judging whether others' lives are worth living. So Parfit is from one particular social background and, you know, has a lot of judgments about like whether the child of a 14-year-old mother's life is worth living, and also about like whether various disabled lives are worth living, that you might think ought to be enriched with some more perspectives. Like, I don't think that the formal structure of any of these problems turns on that, but how good are we at judging whose lives are worth living, and how good do we have to be to make these kinds of decisions?
Well, I think he has quite a low bar. Remember, he doesn't say that the child of the 14-year-old girl is not worth living. The whole point of the puzzle is to claim that the child of the 14-year-old girl is worth living, but nonetheless is not quite as worth living as another life which has a much better start. So he's not claiming that the child of the 14-year-old girl is not worth living. He probably has a very low bar for what counts as worth living. As you say, the logic of the argument is not affected by where the cutoff point is. But wherever the baseline lies, it's still possible for Parfit to claim that there is a better world where there are trillions and trillions of lives which kind of just meet that bar, wherever that bar is, which is a better universe than a universe where there's many small number of lives with very, very rich quality of life.
So this is a fascinating body of philosophy leading to all kinds of different places, really interesting places. And it's, you know, it's met with a lot of fans, I think, including you, Dave, and also some criticism. So there are folks like Elizabeth Camp and Ted Sider who think, well, it's kind of bloodless. Would I really be able to feel my full range of emotions if I didn't feel like I was the same person? Amiya Srinivasan saying it's, you know, going to cost me the strength of my personal attachments, the people whose particularity matters. Another kind of objection I'd love to ask you about is the fact that it's sort of based on science fiction, which, of course, you know, as a literature person, I sort of love. But I have this worry, you know, along with people like Tamar Gendler and Paul Ricoeur, you know, that Parfit seems to be basing his argument on things like a transporter or, you know, being able to divide a brain into two and put it in two bodies and things like that. And, you know, Gendler says, look, if this kind of thing were possible, so much would have changed, right? So much about the world would have changed. So much about our way of thinking would have changed. Can we really trust our intuitions that come out of thinking about these wild science fiction experiments?
So the fission example is based on kind of real cases where they treat people with epilepsy and they cut the cord between the two hemispheres of their brain, and sometimes they've had very strange responses. So people recount that they've got two spheres of consciousness, and I think there was one case where somebody said, you know, on the left hand stream of consciousness they were religious, and on the right hand they were atheist. So it is grounded in real experiments. Now, I've written in the past about the famous trolley problem, where there's an out-of-control trolley and it's going to kill five people, and you have the option of turning the trolley so it just kills one. Philosophy is founded on thought experiments. In almost every aspect of philosophy, it's built on these thought experiments. And you're right, many people criticize these thought experiments because they say they're unreliable. I mean, the defense against these thought experiments is that what you're doing is behaving a bit like a kind of scientist. You're trying to isolate all the factors that matters and only the factors that matter, so that when you test your intuition, that you know your intuition is responding just to those factors that you're trying to think about. Some people say, yeah, the intuitions are sort of very unreliable. I think one can't generalize about all of thought experiments. I think some of them are very useful. I love most of Parfit's thought experiments. I think most of one's intuitions about Parfit's thought experiments are reliable, but I wouldn't generalize to all thought experiments. I'm suspicious of some of them as well.
Well, my intuition is, unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you so much, Dave, for being a fantastic guest and for not punching us on the nose.
Wait till the tape recorder's turned off.
Our guest today has been David Edmonds, co-producer of the Philosophy Bites podcast and author of Parfit, A Philosopher and His Mission to Save Morality. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
Well, I would definitely recommend that our readers go check out this biography. Not only was Parfit full of interesting philosophical ideas like we've been discussing on the show, but he was also a really strange and fascinating person.
Yeah, and Dave really brings out in an interesting way the connections between the life and the thought, as though confirming Nietzsche's point that every philosophy is an involuntary memoir. But we'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now a man so fast he is his future self, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when I was edging towards six, I was in the family car, a cute blue Ford that my father adored, standing up in the front seat. My grandmother, who happened to be with us, visiting, was in the back. She said, "You won't always be able to do that, you know." Though I remained standing, defiantly, my head still quite far from the roof, I had been cruelly schooled. I would become larger, which I never fully realized until that moment. What growth there had been in increments, accompanied by tooth loss, shirts with cowboys on them, toys and cake, so I didn't think of the passage of time as a tragic consequence of being alive. Standing up in the front seat was a perk of childhood that would always be mine to treasure. All was shiny and new, washing machines, chest freezers, everything gleaming like the glint in Uncle Sam's eye. We didn't feel safe, we felt invincible. Not threatening, just ready, and as up to nastiness as any bandito, we would discover. Which we all should have known just from family situations. Keep in mind, my mother was sitting next to me in the vast front seat. I was standing between her and my father, who always drove. Pregnant with my sister at the time, mother was nevertheless ready to snake her arm out should a sudden stop otherwise send me into the dashboard, or worse, through the windshield. I was unaware of the danger I was in, or rather I was immune, like one of Teddy Roosevelt's rough riders running up Sandwall Hill in the face of heavy fire. With Mom's arm there to snake out and shield me. What new eye of the future? Of seat belts, portable kid seats, no smoking. My dad liked the occasional unfiltered Camel as he cruised to the hardware store. Window open, radio tuned to farm reports, rock and roll, not even around the corner. Front and back seats were big as a bed. Babies were conceived at drive-ins across the land as westerns unreeled in the darkness beyond, unwatched. But bucket seats were in the air. Small cars would weasel their way into the world of high-octane. Unleaded gasoline was coming, plummeting pollution and death tolls. I knew none of this. But even if I grew, did that mean I couldn't stand up in the front seat anymore? That's crazy. Might have to hunch a bit, wear a crash helmet. As cars got faster and more powerful, maybe I'd have to gear up like a football player or an astronaut, leather up like the bandits and Road Warrior. Still make Dad drive, though, like a taxi driver or an Uber, free for the family. I didn't see morality enter into it, except maybe the moral issue of cracking my head open and making somebody else clean up the mess. Probably have insurance for that. My family was big on insurance. So I was envisioning this future of very tall children standing up in the front seats of cars that looked like the cockpit of a bomber, only with a plate glass window in front, like a display window for Woolworths or the living room window at the mayor's house, which you would often cruise by on a Sunday drive. Grandmother ruined everything. She was in the back seat with Grandpa, who learned never to say anything to Grandma in the presence of others, and he learned always to keep a window cracked when he smoked a cigar. You'd think that he would have smelled like stale tobacco, but no, he smelled like gun oil and turtle wax. You won't always be able to do that, you know. I won't be able to do this when I'm 21, so I should not do it now. That was the message I was getting. But she was not concerned with my well-being, just making sure that I not fully enjoy whatever experience I have in life, like families have done through the ages. Hard to think about, but at that time, Grandmother and Grandfather were younger than I am now. I have a hunch that she wanted to be in the front seat, which is where she usually sat when driving with Grandpa, so she could tell him where to turn and when. Bringing up age and height just to ruin the simple pleasures of others, all because she forgot to yell shotgun when we were getting in the car. I tell you, it still stings. A lifetime later, I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
You'll shoot your eye out, kid. Merry Christmas.